Hello and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also at pyville.net, our newish social media. In this Learning College, we're going to focus on learning about money, who controls it, where it comes from, and how essentially the Jews took a country without any debt and slave imprisoned it through the creation of the Federal Reserve, and that's the subject of this book. It's called The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. It's by Eustace Mullen, who's a courtly Southern gentleman, a smallish fellow who used to be a researcher at the Library of Congress and worked closely with Ezra Pound. He was kind of his protege, was how he used to refer to Ezra Pound, who was imprisoned in a mental hospital because he disagreed with U.S. foreign policy and he came to understand the true depth of the Jewish problem. Let's dig in. This is a comparatively short, a couple hundred pages book, but it's a very compact, sort of gold covered. The Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins, on the title page. The London Connection, Jekyll Island edition by Eustace Mullins. Published by Bankers Research Institute, P.O. Box 1105, Staunton, VA 24401. Mullins is deceased as we record this in July of 2019. He wrote a number of other books, all of them concerning pretty much the same thing, Jews and particularly finance. And the copy that we have, thanks to a supporter of the Learning College, Author Special 70th Birthday Edition 1993. Library of Congress catalog card number 83-072665, copyright 1993 by Eustace Mullins, E-U-S-T-A-C-E. Not a common name, but see it once in a while. And today we're going to do the prefatory material and also chapter 1. So we'll run up to page 10. These are very dense, tight pages, so it's longer than it might appear. Dedicated to two of the finest scholars of the 20th century, George Stimson and Ezra Pound, who generously gave of their vast knowledge to a young writer to guide him in a field in which he could not have managed alone. Acknowledgements. I wish to thank my former fellow members of the staff of the Library of Congress, whose very kind assistance, cooperation, and suggestions made the early version of this book possible. I also wish to thank the staffs of the Newberry Library, Chicago, the New York City Public Library, the Alderman Library of the University of Virginia, and the McCormick Library of Washington and Lee University, Lexington, Virginia, for their invaluable assistance in the completion of 30 years of further research for this definitive work on the Federal Reserve System. And I actually briefly met Mullins, I think the Media Bypass Conference, back around early 2000 to 2005 period, and he was operative clearly in Washington, D.C. and Southern Virginia is basically his home quarters. Turning the page. About the author. Eustace Mullins is a veteran of the United States Air Force with 38 months of active service during World War II. A native Virginian, he was educated at Washington and Lee University, New York University, Ohio University, the University of North Dakota, the Escuelas de Bellas Artes San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, and the Institute of Contemporary Arts in Washington, D.C. Never heard of that last. Institute of Contemporary Arts. The original book, published under the title Mullins on the Federal Reserve, was commissioned by the poet Ezra Pound in 1948. So after the war, Mullins is in the insane asylum. They threw him in unjustly in order to taint and prejudice what he was saying, so he needed someone to do research for him, and he deputed Mullins. Ezra Pound was a political prisoner for 13 and a half years at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, Washington, D.C., a federal institution for the insane. His release was accomplished largely through the efforts of Mr. Mullins. So that's how the protege paid back his mentor, by getting him freed. The research at the Library of Congress was directed and reviewed daily by George Stimson, founder of the National Press Club in Washington, whom the New York Times on September 28, 1952 called, quote, a highly regarded reference source in the Capitol. Government officials, congressmen, and reporters went to him for information on any subject. And NPC is a place where all kinds of different groups will put on press releases. We used to sneak around in there back in the day when I was a trade journalist out in D.C. But basically, it's just a sort of a little barn where they put on PR shows. During the intervening years, the author continued to gather new and more startling information about the backgrounds of the people who direct the Federal Reserve policies. New information gathered over the years from hundreds of newspapers, periodicals, and books give corroborating insight into the connections of the international banking houses, asterisk, which reads, the London Acceptance Council is limited to 17 international banking houses authorized by the Bank of England to handle foreign exchange. Now again, Mullins' main claim here is going to be that he broke the news. He broke the story about Jekyll Island, essentially, you know, decades after the fact. Maybe it was slightly reported or guessed at a little bit at the time, but no one really saw the significance until decades later. So he's basically, The Creature from Jekyll Island is the most famous book about all this, which I highly recommend you read. You can find that around, The Creature from Jekyll Island, but that's based on reporting that Eustace Mullins did originally, and he will even say that. While researching this material, Eustace Mullins was on the staff of the Library of Congress. Mullins later was a consultant on highway finance for the American Petroleum Institute. That's typical of the sort of trade organization you would find headquartered in D.C., and they need writers and researchers and what all, and that's what, and I worked in stuff like that, and he worked in stuff like that. Most journalism is trade stuff. It's not political stuff like you think when you think of journalist. Consultant on hotel development for Institutions Magazine and editorial director for the Chicago Motor Club's four publications. So, now see, Eustace Mullins is qualified to write for something like, say, the Washington Times or some other right-wing publication, but you can't do that if you criticize Jews. So if you're able to get any journalism job at all, you're going to be in something non-directly political that no one ever hears about. And you have to do your writing on the side, but you still need money to live, you see? This is how they keep the accurate views out of the mainstream. Turning the page. About the cover, which basically shows an eagle gripping arrows. The cover reproduces the outline of the eagle from the red shield, that's Rothschild in German, Rot, R-O-T, red, Schild, shield, the coat of arms of the city of Frankfurt, Germany, adapted by Meyer Amschel Bauer, 1744 to 1812, who changed his name from Bauer to Rothschild, red shield, Rothschild, Rothschild. Rothschild added five golden arrows held in the eagle's talons, signifying his five sons who operated the five banking houses of the International House of Rothschild, Frankfurt, London, Paris, Vienna, and Naples. Table of contents, we see there's 14 chapters, an addendum, appendix, biographies, bibliography, index. Chapter 1, Jekyll Island. Flipping the page. We have a signed letter from a congressman. Congress of the United States, House of Representatives, Washington, D.C., Texarkana, November 23, 1953. Mr. Eustace Mullins, American Petroleum Industries Committee, 50 West 50th Street, New York 20, New York. Dear Mr. Mullins, I want to thank you very much for your letter in which you refer to Colonel Allen's column about an investigation of the Federal Reserve System. Your book is among the few books that I have on my desk, Mr. Mullins, that I often refer to. It is a very fine book and has been very useful to me. When I return to Washington, if you are down that way, I would like to have the privilege of seeing you and visiting with you. Thanking you again for the book and for your letter, I am, sincerely yours, Wright Patman. U.S. Congress, 1929 to 1976, House Banking and Currency Committee, 1937 to 1976. So the big shot through the middle decades. So the things were slightly looser back then. You could have some associations that the Jews might not even like, but if they weren't too mainstream. And then a couple other epigraphs, more or less, or supportive quotes. Other testimonials from many business and political leaders praising my book on the Federal Reserve System included the following. I am very grateful that your book has called my attention to those long-ignored congressional hearings on the 1929 stock market crash, said Colonel Robert R. McCormick, publisher of the Chicago Tribune, and the employer of Donald Day, who wrote Onward Christian Soldier and some of the only honest Jew-critical reporting about the Soviet Union and the communizing of Eastern Europe, and we've covered him in earlier Learning College audio recordings. And finally, from Robert Taft, your book has been, and I am sure will continue to be, very useful to me. However, I would appreciate your not using my name in connection with it until appropriate legislation can be prepared to remedy some of the abuses of the Federal Reserve System. Senator Robert Taft, Republican Majority Leader in Congress. So he doesn't want any flack coming from publicly making note of this book, telling the truth about the Federal Reserve. Robert Taft, the one who ran for president and said the exits are clearly marked for anyone who is a white nationalist in sympathy. And finally, we've got a facsimile of portions of the first and final pages of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The above facsimile is reproduced from page 60 of Historical Beginnings, the Federal Reserve, published by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston in its seventh printing, 1982. And the facsimile shows 63rd Congress of the United States of America at the second session, begun and held at the city of Washington on Monday, the first day of December, 1913, an act to provide for the establishment of Federal Reserve banks to furnish an elastic currency, to afford means of discounting or rediscounting commercial paper, to establish a more effective supervision of banking in the United States and for other purposes. Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the short title of this act shall be the Federal Reserve Act. Signed by the Speaker of the House and Thomas R. Marshall, Vice President of the United States and President of the Senate. Can't tell who the Speaker of the House is. Approved 23 December 1913, Woodrow Wilson. Now the foreword, and then the introduction in chapter one. Foreword. In 1949, while I was visiting Ezra Pound, who was a political prisoner at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, Washington, D.C., a federal institution for the insane, Dr. Pound asked me if I'd ever heard of the Federal Reserve System. I replied that I had not, as of the age of 25. He then showed me a $10 bill marked Federal Reserve Note and asked me if I would do some research at the Library of Congress on the Federal Reserve System which had issued this bill. Pound was unable to go to the library himself as he was being held without trial as a political prisoner by the United States government. After he was denied broadcasting time in the U.S., Dr. Pound broadcast from Italy in an effort to persuade people of the United States not to enter World War II. Franklin D. Roosevelt had personally ordered Pound's indictment, spurred by the demands of his three personal assistants, Harry Dexter White, Lachlan Curry, and Alger Hiss, all of whom were subsequently identified as being connected with communist espionage. Yeah, they were communists. I had no interest in money or banking as a subject because I was working on a novel. Pound offered to supplement my income by $10 a week for a few weeks. My initial research revealed evidence of an international banking group which had secretly planned the writing of the Federal Reserve Act and Congress's enactment of the plan into law. These findings confirmed what Pound had long suspected. He said, "You must work on it as a detective story." The Federal Reserve's founding. I was fortunate in having my research at the Library of Congress directed by a prominent scholar, George Stimson, founder of the National Press Club, who was described by the New York Times of September 28, 1952, quote, "Beloved by Washington newspapermen as our walking Library of Congress, Mr. Stimson was a highly regarded reference source in the Capitol. Government officials, congressmen, and reporters went to him for information on any subject." I did research 4 hours each day at the Library of Congress and went to St. Elizabeth's Hospital in the afternoon. Pound and I went over the previous day's notes. I then had dinner with George Stimson at Shoals Cafeteria while he went over my material, and I then went back to my room to type up the corrected notes. Both Stimson and Pound made many suggestions in guiding me in a field in which I had no previous experience. When Pound's resources ran low, I applied to the Guggenheim Foundation, Huntington-Hartford Foundation, and other foundations to complete my research on the Federal Reserve, even though my foundation applications were sponsored by the three leading poets of America, Ezra Pound, E.E. Cummings, and Elizabeth Bishop. All of the foundations refused to sponsor this research. I then wrote up my findings to date, and in 1950 began efforts to market this manuscript in New York. 18 publishers turned it down without comment, but the 19th, Devin Garrity, president of Devin Adair Publishing Company, gave me some friendly advice in his office. "I like your book, but we can't print it," he told me. "Neither can anybody else in New York. Why don't you bring in your prospectus for your novel, and I think we can give you an advance. You may as well forget about getting the Federal Reserve book published. I doubt if it could ever be printed." So he shops it around to a couple dozen publishers. They all reject it, and one of them actually tells him, "Look, there's no way you can get this published." This was devastating news coming after 2 years of intensive work. I reported back to Pound, and we tried to find a publisher in other parts of the country. Again, long before the internet is even a conception. After 2 years of fruitless submissions, the book was published in a small edition in 1952 by two of Pound's disciples, John Casper and David Horton, using their private funds under the title Mullins on the Federal Reserve. In 1954, a second edition with unauthorized alterations was published in New Jersey as The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. In 1955, Guido Roeder, R-O-E-D-E-R, brought out a German edition in Oberammergau, Germany, which is famous for the Passion Play, its location. The book was seized and the entire edition of 10,000 copies burned by government agents led by Dr. Otto John, J-O-H-N. So, German edition is seized and burned, 10,000 copies. The burning of the book was upheld April 21, 1961, by Judge Israel Katz of the Bavarian Supreme Court. The U.S. government refused to intervene because U.S. High Commissioner on Germany, James B. Conant, president of Harvard University, 1933 to 1953, had approved the initial book burning order. This is the only book which has been burned in Germany since World War II. I don't know about that. They burned all of the National Socialist materials they could find. In 1968, a pirated edition of this book appeared in California. Both the FBI and the U.S. Postal Inspectors refused to act, despite numerous complaints from me during the next decade. In 1980, a new German edition appeared. Because the U.S. government apparently no longer dictated the internal affairs of Germany, the identical book, which had been burned in 1955, now circulates in Germany without interference. I had collaborated on several books with Mr. H.L. Hunt, and he suggested that I should continue my long-delayed research on the Federal Reserve and bring out a more definitive version of the book. Of this book, I had just signed a contract to write the authorized biography of Ezra Pound, and the Federal Reserve book had to be postponed. Mr. Hunt passed away before I could get back to my research, and once again I faced the problem of financing research for this book. My original book had traced and named the shadowy figures in the United States who planned the Federal Reserve Act. I now discovered that the men whom I exposed in 1952 as the shadowy figures behind the operation of the Federal Reserve System were themselves shadows, the American fronts for the unknown figures who became known as the, quote, London Connection. I found that notwithstanding our successes in the Wars of Independence in 1812 against England, we remained an economic and financial colony of Great Britain. For the first time, we located the original stockholders of the Federal Reserve Banks and traced their parent companies to the London Connection. This research is substantiated by citations and documentation from hundreds of newspapers, periodicals, and books and charts showing blood, marriage, and business relationships. More than 1,000 issues of the New York Times on microfilm have been checked, not only for original information, but verification of statements from other sources. It is a truism of the writing profession that a writer has only one book within him. This seems applicable in my case, because I am now in the fifth decade of continuous writing on a single subject, the inside story of the Federal Reserve System. This book was, from its inception, commissioned and guided by Ezra Pound. Four of his protégés have been previously awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, William Butler Yeats for his later poetry, James Joyce for Ulysses, Ernest Hemingway for The Sun Also Rises, and T.S. Eliot for The Wasteland. Pound played a major role in the inspiration and in the editing of these works, which leads us to believe that this present work, also inspired by Pound, represents an ongoing literary tradition. Although this book in its inception was expected to be a torturous work on economic and monetary techniques, it soon developed into a story of such universal and dramatic appeal that from the outset, Ezra Pound urged me to write it as a detective story, a genre which was invented by my fellow Virginian, Edgar Allan Poe. I believe that the continuous circulation of this book during the past 40 years has not only exonerated Ezra Pound for his much-condemned political and monetary statements, but also that it has been, and will continue to be, the ultimate weapon against the powerful conspirators who compelled him to serve 13 and a half years without trial as a political prisoner held in an insane asylum a la KGB. His earliest vindication came when the government agents who represented the conspirators refused to allow him to testify in his own defense. The second vindication came in 1958 when these same agents dropped all charges against him and he walked out of St. Elizabeth's Hospital a free man once more. His third and final vindication is this work, which documents every aspect of his exposure of the ruthless international financiers to whom Ezra Pound became but one more victim, doomed to serve as the years as the man in the iron mask because he had dared to alert his fellow Americans to their furtive acts of treason against all people of the United States. In my lectures throughout this nation and in my appearances on many radio and television programs, I have sounded the tocsin that the Federal Reserve System is not federal. It has no reserves. It is not a system at all, but rather a criminal syndicate. From November 1910, when the conspirators met on Jekyll Island, Georgia, to the present time, the machinations of the Federal Reserve bankers have been shrouded in secrecy. Today, that secrecy has cost the American people a $3 trillion debt. Of course, it's a lot higher than that today, with annual interest payments to these bankers amounting to some $300 billion per year, sums which stagger the imagination and which in themselves are ultimately unpayable. Officials of the Federal Reserve System routinely issue remonstrances to the public, much as the Hindu faker pipes an insistent tune to the dazed cobra which sways its head before him, not to resolve the situation, but to prevent it from striking at him. Well, most of those cobras have their teeth taken out anyway. Such was the soothing letter written by Donald J. Wynne, assistant to the Board of Governors, in response to an inquiry by a congressman, the Honorable Norman D. Shumway, on March 10, 1983. Mr. Wynne states that, quote, "The Federal Reserve was established by an act of Congress in 1913 and is not a private corporation." On the next page, Mr. Wynne continues, "The stock of the Federal Reserve banks is held entirely by commercial banks that are members of the Federal Reserve System." He offers no explanation as to why the government has never owned a single share of stock in any Federal Reserve bank, or why the Federal Reserve System is not a private corporation when all of its stock is owned by private corporations. American history in the 20th century has recorded the amazing achievements of the Federal Reserve bankers. First, the outbreak of World War I, which was made possible by the funds available from the new Central Bank of the United States. Second, the agricultural depression of 1920. Third, the Black Friday crash on Wall Street of October 1929 and the ensuing Great Depression. Fourth, World War II. Fifth, the conversion of the assets of the United States and its citizens from real property to paper assets from 1945 to the present, transforming a victorious America and foremost world power in 1945 to the world's largest debtor nation in 1990. Today, this nation lies in economic ruins, devastated and destitute, in much the same dire straits in which Germany and Japan found themselves in 1945. Will Americans act to rebuild our nation as Germany and Japan have done when they faced the identical conditions which we now face? Or will we continue to be enslaved by the Babylonian debt money system which was set up by the Federal Reserve Act in 1913 to complete our total destruction? This is the only question which we have to answer, and we do not have much time left to answer it. And of course, as we read, we're in a much worse situation now than we were when he wrote those words in the early 90s. Because of the depth and the importance of the information which I had developed at the Library of Congress under the tutelage of Ezra Pound, this work became the happy hunting ground for many other would-be historians who were unable to research this material for themselves. Over the past four decades, I have become accustomed to seeing this material appear in many other books, invariably attributed to other writers, with my name never mentioned. To add insult to injury, not only my material, but even my title has been appropriated in a massive, if obtuse, work called Secrets of the Temple, the Federal Reserve. This heavily advertised book received reviews ranging from incredulous to hilarious. Forbes magazine advised its readers to read their review and save their money, pointing out that a reader will discover no secrets, and that this is one of those books whose fanfares far exceed their merit. This was not accidental, as this overblown whitewash of the Federal Reserve bankers was published by the most famous non-book publisher in the world. After my initial shock at discovering that the most influential literary personality of the 20th century, Ezra Pound, was imprisoned in, quote, the hellhole in Washington, I immediately wrote for assistance to a Wall Street financier at whose estate I had frequently been a guest. I reminded him that as a patron of the arts, he could not afford to allow Pound to remain in such inhuman captivity. His reply shocked me even more. He wrote back that, quote, your friend can well stay where he is. It was some years before I was able to understand that, for this investment banker and his colleagues, Ezra Pound would always be, quote, the enemy, unquote. Conclusion. Eustace Mullins, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, 1991. And that's the end of the foreword. And then we've got a introduction, just a brief two-page, and then chapter one. Anyway, so if you tell the truth about the financial system, you get thrown in a mental institution. That's what happened in the 20th century. It doesn't matter how famous or artistically talented you are. Introduction. We've got an epigraph from Ezra Pound out of the hospital. Here are the simple facts of the Great Betrayal. Wilson and House knew that they were doing something momentous. One cannot fathom men's motives, and this pair probably believed in what they were up to. What they did not believe in was representative government. They believed in government, Woodrow Wilson. They believed in government by an uncontrolled oligarchy whose acts would only become apparent after an interval so long that the electorate would be forever incapable of doing anything efficient to remedy depredations. So yeah, the truth will eventually sneak out, but it'll be too late to do anything about it. Author's note. Dr. Pound wrote this introduction for the earliest version of this book, published by Casper and Horton, New York, 1952. Because he was being held as a political prisoner without trial by the federal government, he could not afford to allow his name to appear in the book because of additional reprisals against him. Neither could he allow the book to be dedicated to him, although he had commissioned its writing. The author is gratified to be able to remedy these necessary omissions 33 years after the event. Turning the page, and we've got a copy of Jefferson's Opinion on the Constitutionality of the Bank. February 15, 1791. Last thing before chapter 1. and the text proper. The writings of Thomas Jefferson, edited by H.E. Berg, B-E-R-G-H, Volume 3, page 145, FF. The bill for establishing a national bank in 1791 undertakes, among other things, 1. To form the subscribers into a corporation. 2. To enable them in their corporate capacities to receive grants of land, and so far is against the laws of mortmain. 3. To make alien subscribers capable of holding lands, and so far is against the laws of alienage. He's pointing out all the ways in which it's illegal. 4. To transmit these lands on the death of a proprietor to a certain line of successors, and so far changes the course of descents. 5. To put the lands out of the reach of forfeiture or escheat, and so far is against the laws of, and and so far is his way of saying it, and if they're doing that, this is against the laws of forfeiture and escheat, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. These are legal terms. Saying they propose this, and so far as they go to do that, it's against the law, this, that, or the other law. To transmit personal chattels to successors in a certain line, and so far as against the laws of distribution. 7. To give them the sole and exclusive right of banking under the national authority, and so far as against the laws of monopoly. And all these are in italics, these laws or principles against which this proposal offends. Descents, mortmain, alien, alienage, forfeiture, escheat, distribution, monopoly. 8. To communicate to them a power to make laws paramount to the laws of the states, for so they must be construed, to protect the institution from the control of the state legislatures, and so probably they will be construed. I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground, says Jefferson, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states or to the people. 12th Amendment. To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible of any definition. The incorporation of a bank and the powers assumed by this bill have not, in my opinion, been delegated to the United States by the Constitution. So you can write whatever you want on paper, but does that mean people will follow it? No. Chapter 1, Jekyll Island, which is an island off the coast of Georgia and which stands for the secret conclave that produced the Federal Reserve. The matter of a uniform discount rate was discussed and settled at Jekyll Island, said Paul M. Warburg, the guiding Jew spirit behind all this. As we are on now page 1 in the proper chapter, 10 pages, or 9 pages. On the night of November 22, 1910, a group of newspaper reporters stood disconsolately in the railway station at Hoboken, New Jersey. They had just watched a delegation of the nation's leading financiers leave the station on a secret mission. November 22, 1910. It would be years before they discovered what that mission was, and even then they would not understand that the history of the United States underwent a drastic change after that night in Hoboken. The delegation had left in a sealed railway car with blinds drawn for an undisclosed location. They were led by Senator Nelson Aldrich, head of the National Monetary Commission. President Theodore Roosevelt had signed it into law a bill creating the National Monetary Commission in 1908 after the tragic panic of 1907 had resulted in a public outcry that the nation's monetary system be stabilized. Aldrich had led some of the members of the commission on a 2-year tour of Europe, spending some $300,000 of public money. He had not yet made a report on the results of this trip, nor had he offered any plan for banking reform. Accompanying Senator Aldrich at the Hoboken station were his private secretary, Shelton, A. Pyatt Andrew, assistant secretary of the Treasury, and special assistant to the National Monetary Commission, was Pyatt Andrew, A. Pyatt Andrew. Frank Vanderlip, president of the National City Bank of New York, Henry P. Davidson, senior partner of J.P. Morgan & Company, generally regarded as Morgan's personal emissary, and Charles D. Norton, president of the Morgan-dominated First National Bank of New York. Joining the group just before the train left the station were Benjamin Strong, also known as a lieutenant of J.P. Morgan, and Paul Warburg, a recent immigrant from Germany who had joined the banking house of Kuhn Loeb & Company, New York, as a partner earning $500,000 a year. 6 years later, a financial writer named Bernie Charles Forbes, who later founded the Forbes magazine, the president editor Malcolm Forbes is his son, wrote, long block quote, Bernie Charles Forbes wrote, "Picture a party of the nation's greatest bankers stealing out of New York in a private railroad car under cover of darkness, stealthily hieing hundreds of miles south, embarking on a mysterious launch, sneaking onto an island deserted by all but a few servants, living there a full week under such rigid secrecy that the names of not one of them was once mentioned, lest the servants learn the identity and disclose to the world this strangest, most secret expedition in the history of American finance. I am not romancing. I am giving to the world, for the first time, the real story of how the famous Aldrich Currency Report, the foundation of our new currency system, was written. The utmost secrecy was enjoined upon all. The public must not glean a hint of what was to be done. Senator Aldrich notified each one to go quietly into a private car of which the railroad had received orders to draw up on an unfrequented platform. Off the party set. New York's ubiquitous reporters had been foiled. Nelson Aldrich had confided to Henry, Frank, Paul, and Pyatt that he was to keep them locked up at Jekyll Island, out of the rest of the world, until they had evolved and compiled a scientific currency system for the United States, the real birth of the present Federal Reserve System. The plan done on Jekyll Island in the conference with Paul, Frank, and Henry Warburg is the link that binds the Aldrich system and the present system together. He, more than any one man, has made the system possible as a working reality." And his source, one of his main sources, Nathaniel Wright Stevenson, Nelson W. Aldrich, A Leader in American Politics, Scribner's, New York, 1930, chapter XXIV, Jekyll Island. The official biography of Senator Nelson Aldrich states, "In the autumn of 1910, six men went out to shoot ducks. Aldrich, his secretary Shelton, Andrews, Davison, Vanderlip, and Warburg. Reporters were waiting at the Brunswick, Georgia, station. Mr. Davison went out and talked to them. The reporters dispersed, and the secret of this strange journey was not divulged. Mr. Aldrich asked him how he had managed it, and he did not volunteer the information. Davison had an excellent reputation as the person who could conciliate warring factions, a role he had performed for J.P. Morgan during the settling of the money panic of 1907. Another Morgan partner, T.W. Lamont, says, "Henry P. Davison served as arbitrator of the Jekyll Island expedition." From these references, it is possible to piece together the story. Aldrich's private car, which had left Hoboken Station with its shades drawn, had taken the financiers to Jekyll Island, Georgia. Some years earlier, a very exclusive group of millionaires, led by J.P. Morgan, had purchased the island as a winter retreat. They called themselves the Jekyll Island Hunt Club, and at first, the island was used only for hunting expeditions, until the millionaires realized that its pleasant climate offered a warm retreat from the rigors of winters in New York, and began to build splendid mansions, which they called cottages, for their families' winter vacations. The club building itself, being quite isolated, was sometimes in demand for stag parties and other pursuits unrelated to hunting. On such occasions, the club members who were not invited to these specific outings were asked not to appear there for a certain number of days. Before Nelson Aldrich's party had left New York, the club's members had been notified that the club would be occupied for the next 2 weeks. The Jekyll Island Club was chosen as the place to draft the plan for control of the money and credit of the people of the United States, not only because of its isolation, but also because it was the private preserve of the people who were drafting the plan. The New York Times later noted, on May 3, 1931, in commenting on the death of George F. Baker, one of J.P. Morgan's closest associates, that, quote, "Jekyll Island Club has lost one of its most distinguished members. One-sixth of the total wealth of the world was represented by the members of the Jekyll Island Club. Membership was by inheritance only." The Aldrich Group had no interest in hunting. Jekyll Island was chosen for the site of the preparation of the central bank because it offered complete privacy and because there was not a journalist within 50 miles. Such was the need for secrecy that the members of the party agreed, before arriving at Jekyll Island, that no last names would be used at any time during their two-week stay. The group later referred to themselves as the First Name Club, as the last names of Warburg, Strong, Vanderlip, and others were prohibited during their stay. The customary attendants had been given two-week vacations from the club, and new servants brought in from the mainland for this occasion who did not know the names of any of those present. Even if they had been interrogated after the Aldrich party went back to New York, they could not have given the names. This arrangement proved to be so satisfactory that the members, limited to those who had actually been present at Jekyll Island, later had a number of informal get-togethers in New York. Why all this secrecy? Why this 1,000-mile trip in a closed railway car to a remote hunting club? Ostensibly, it was to carry out a program of public service, to prepare banking reform, which would be a boon to the people of the United States, which had been ordered by the National Monetary Commission. The participants were no strangers to public benefactions. Usually, their names were inscribed on brass plaques or on the exteriors of buildings which they had donated. This was not the procedure which they followed at Jekyll Island. No brass plaque was ever erected to mark the selfless actions of those who met at their private hunt club in 1910 to improve the lot of every citizen of the United States. In fact, no benefaction took place at Jekyll Island. The Aldrich Group journeyed there in private to write the banking and currency legislation which the National Monetary Commission had been ordered to prepare in public. At stake was the future of the control of the money and credit of the United States. If any genuine monetary reform had been prepared and presented to Congress, it would have ended the power of the elitist, one-world money creators. Jekyll Island ensured that a central bank would be established in the United States, which would give these bankers everything they always wanted. As the most technically proficient of those present, Paul Warburg was charged with doing most of the drafting of the plan. His work would then be discussed and gone over by the rest of the group. Senator Nelson Aldrich was there to see that the completed plan would come out in a form which could get passed by Congress, and the other bankers were there to include whatever details would be needed to be certain that they got everything they wanted in a finished draft composed during a one-time stay. After they returned to New York, there could be no second get-together to rework their plan. They could not hope to obtain such secrecy for their work on a second journey. The Jekyll Island group remained at the club for 9 days, working furiously to complete their task. Despite the common interests of those present, the work did not proceed without friction. Senator Aldrich, always a domineering person, considered himself the chosen leader of the group and could not help ordering everybody else about. Aldrich also felt somewhat out of place as the only member who was not a professional banker. He had had substantial banking interests throughout his career, but only as a person who profited from his ownership of bank stock. He knew little about the technical aspects of financial operations. His opposite number, Paul Warburg, believed that every question raised by the group demanded not merely an answer, but a lecture. He rarely lost an opportunity to give the members a long discourse designed to impress them with the extent of his knowledge of banking. This was resented by the others and often drew barbed remarks from Aldrich. The natural diplomacy of Henry P. Davison proved to be the catalyst which kept them at their work. Warburg's thick alien accent grated on them, this Jew from Germany, and constantly reminded them that they had to accept his presence if a central bank plan was to be devised which would guarantee their future profits. Warburg made little effort to smooth over their prejudices and contested them on every possible occasion on technical banking questions, which he considered his private preserve. Quote, "In all conspiracies, there must be great secrecy." The monetary reform plan prepared at Jekyll Island was to be presented to Congress as the completed work of the National Monetary Commission. So the panic in 1907, and National Monetary Commission is charged with reforming the laws, and this is what they're doing in 1910 at Jekyll Island, except it's not reform. It's let's establish a central bank that will empower us all to rob everybody else in the world. It was imperative that the real authors of the bill remain hidden. So great was popular resentment against bankers since the panic of 1907 that no congressman would dare to vote for a bill bearing the Wall Street taint, no matter who had contributed to his campaign expenses. The Jekyll Island plan was a central bank plan, and in this country there was a long tradition of struggle against inflicting a central bank on the American people. It had begun with Thomas Jefferson's fight against Alexander Hamilton's scheme for the first bank of the United States, backed by James Rothschild. It had continued with President Andrew's successful war against Alexander Hamilton's scheme for the second bank of the United States, in which Nicholas Biddle was acting as the agent for James Rothschild of Paris. The result of that struggle was the creation of the independent sub-treasury system, which supposedly had served to keep the funds of the United States out of the hands of the financiers. A study of the panics of 1873, 1893, and 1907 indicates that these panics were the result of the international bankers' operations in London. The public was demanding in 1908 that Congress enact legislation to prevent the recurrence of artificially induced money panics. Such monetary reform now seemed inevitable. It was to head off and control such reform that the National Monetary Commission had been set up with Nelson Aldrich at its head, since he was majority leader of the Senate. The main problem, as Paul Warburg informed his colleagues, was to avoid the name central bank. For that reason, he had decided upon the designation of Federal Reserve System. This would deceive the people into thinking that it was not a central bank. However, the Jekyll Island plan would be a central bank plan, fulfilling the main functions of a central bank. It would be owned by private individuals who would profit from ownership of shares. As a bank of issue, it would control the nation's money and credit. So Congress is supposed to control that, but if through this act, it's going to grant that power to this collection of private banks rather than assuming it itself, as it's supposed to by law. In the chapter on Jekyll Island in his biography of Aldrich, Stevenson writes of the conference, "How is the Reserve Bank to be controlled? It must be controlled by Congress. The government was to be represented in the board of directors. It was to have full knowledge of all the bank's affairs, but a majority of the directors were to be chosen, directly or indirectly, by the banks of association." So the bankers policing themselves, and maybe someone from Congress there to listen in. Thus, the proposed Federal Reserve Bank was to be, quote, controlled by Congress and answerable to the government, but the majority of the directors were to be chosen, quote, directly or indirectly, unquote, by the banks of the association. In the final refinement of Warburg's plan, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors would be appointed by the President of the United States, but the real work of the board would be controlled by a Federal Advisory Council meeting with the governors. The council would be chosen by the directors of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks and would remain unknown to the public. The next consideration was to conceal the fact that the proposed Federal Reserve System would be dominated by the masters of the New York money market. The congressmen from the South and the West could not survive if they voted for a Wall Street plan. Farmers and small businessmen in those areas had suffered most from the money panics. There had been great popular resentment against the Eastern bankers, which during the 19th century became a political movement known as populism. Resentment against Eastern bankers, populism. The private papers of Nicholas Biddle, not released until more than a century after his death, show that quite early on, the Eastern bankers were fully aware of the widespread public opposition to them. Paul Warburg advanced at Jekyll Island the primary deception, which would prevent the citizens from recognizing that his plan set up a central bank. This was the Regional Reserve System. He proposed a system of four, later 12, branch reserve banks located in different sections of the country, few people outside the banking world would realize that the existing concentration of the nation's money and credit structure in New York made the proposal of a regional reserve system a delusion. So the appearance that it's spread out over the country, the reality is it's run out of New York, and the reality that it is in fact a central bank. It's just not called that. It doesn't have that form on paper, but it is. Another proposal advanced by Paul Warburg at Jekyll Island was the manner of selection of administrators for the proposed regional reserve system. Senator Nelson Aldrich had insisted that the officials should be appointive, not elective, and that Congress should have no role in their selection. His Capitol Hill experience had taught him that congressional opinion would often be inimical, hostile, to the Wall Street interests, as congressmen from the West and South might wish to demonstrate to their constituents that they were protecting them against the Eastern bankers. Warburg responded that the administrators of the proposed central bank should be subject to executive approval by the president. This patent removal of the system from congressional control meant that the Federal Reserve proposal was unconstitutional from its inception, because the Federal Reserve System was to be a bank of issue, which is supposed to be Congress. Article 1, Section 8, Part 5 of the Constitution expressly charges Congress with, quote, the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. Warburg's plan would deprive Congress of its sovereignty, and the systems of checks and balances of power set up by Thomas Jefferson and the Constitution would now be destroyed. Administrators of the proposed system would control the nation's money and credit, and would themselves be approved by the executive department of the government. The judicial department, the Supreme Court, etc., was already virtually controlled by the executive department through presidential appointments to the bench. Paul Warburg later wrote a massive exposition of his plan, The Federal Reserve System, Its Origin and Growth, of some 1,750 pages, but the name Jekyll Island appears nowhere in this text, in typical Jewish honesty. He does state, Volume 1, page 58, in November 1910, I was invited to join a small group of men who, at Senator Aldrich's request, were to take part in a several days conference with him to discuss the form that the new banking bill should take. During this conference, I had my first opportunity of studying the senator carefully, and I was deeply impressed by the earnest devotion with which he approached the subject and the untiring patience with which he applied himself to it. Close quote from Warburg about Aldrich. It is noteworthy that Warburg does not disclose who attended this conference or where it took place, even though it was a momentous gathering which would decide the future control of the money and credit of the people of the United States. He continues, but then the conference closed after a week of earnest deliberation. The rough draft of what later became the Aldrich Bill had been agreed upon, and a plan had been outlined which provided for a National Reserve Association, meaning a central reserve organization with an elastic note issue based on gold and commercial paper. On page 60, Warburg writes, the results of the conference were entirely confidential. Even the fact there had been a meeting was not permitted to become public. He adds in a footnote, though 18 years have since gone by, I do not feel free to give a description of this most interesting conference, concerning which Senator Aldrich pledged all participants to secrecy. B.C. Forbes's revelation of the secret expedition to Jekyll Island had had surprisingly little impact. It did not appear in print until 2 years after the Federal Reserve Act had been passed by Congress, hence it was never read during the period where it could have had an effect, that is, during the congressional debate on the bill. Forbes' story was also dismissed by those, quote, in the know as preposterous and a mere invention. Now, you're lying. There wasn't any secret group of bankers meeting to create a central bank, masquerading as something else. That never happened. Stevenson mentions this on page 484 of his book about Aldrich. Quote, this curious episode of Jekyll Island has been generally regarded as a myth. B.C. Forbes got some information from one of the reporters. It told in vague outline the Jekyll Island story, but made no impression and was generally regarded as a mere yarn. Lie, lie, lie. The cover-up of the Jekyll Island conference proceeded along two lines, both of which were successful. The first, as Stevenson mentions, was to dismiss the entire story as a romantic concoction which never actually took place. Although there were brief references to Jekyll Island in later books concerning the Federal Reserve System, these also attracted little public attention. As we have noted, Warburg's massive and supposedly definitive work on the Federal Reserve System does not mention Jekyll Island at all, although he does admit that a conference took place. In none of his voluminous speeches or writings do the words Jekyll Island appear, with a single notable exception. He agreed to Professor Stevenson's request that he prepare a brief statement for the Aldrich biography. This appears on page 485 as part of, quote, the Warburg Memorandum. In this excerpt, Warburg writes, the matter of a uniform discount rate was discussed and settled at Jekyll Island. Another member of the First Name Club was less reticent. Frank Vanderlip later published a few brief references to the conference. In the Saturday Evening Post, February 9, 1935, page 25, so 25 or 20 years later, Vanderlip wrote, quote, despite my views about the value to society of greater publicity for the affairs of corporations, there was an occasion near the close of 1910 when I was as secretive, indeed as furtive, as any conspirator. Since it would have been fatal to Senator Aldrich's plan to have known that he was calling on anybody from Wall Street to help him in preparing this bill, precautions were taken that would have delighted the heart of James Stillman, a colorful and secretive banker who was president of the National City Bank during the Spanish-American War, and who is thought to have been involved in getting us into that war. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. In a travel feature in the Washington Post, March 27, 1983, quote, follow the rich to Jekyll Island, Roy Hoops writes, H-O-O-P-E-S, in 1910, when Aldrich and four financial experts wanted a place to meet in secret to reform the country's banking system, they faked a hunting trip to Jekyll Island and for 10 days holed up in the clubhouse where they made plans for what would eventually become the Federal Reserve Bank. Vanderlip later wrote in his autobiography, From Farm Boy to Financier, quote, our secret expedition to Jekyll Island was the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. The essential points of the Aldrich plan were all contained in the Federal Reserve Act as it was passed. Professor E.R.A. Seligman, a member of the international banking family of J.W. Seligman, and head of the Department of Economics at Columbia University, wrote in an essay published by the Academy of Political Science, Proceedings, Volume 4, Number 4, page 387-90, E.R.A. Seligman says, quote, it is known to a very few how great is the indebtedness of the United States to Mr. Warburg. For it may be said without fear of contradiction that in its fundamental features the Federal Reserve Act is the work of Mr. Warburg more than any other man in the country, Jew from Germany. The existence of a Federal Reserve Board creates, in everything but in name, a real central bank. The Federal Reserve Board is a real central bank. In the two fundamentals of command of reserves and of a discount policy, the Federal Reserve Act has frankly accepted the principle of the Aldrich Bill, and these principles, as has been stated, were the creation of Mr. Warburg and Mr. Warburg alone. It must not be forgotten that Mr. Warburg had a practical object in view. In formulating his plans and in advancing them, slightly varying suggestions from time to time, it was incumbent on him to remember that the education of the country must be gradual and that a large part of the task was to break down prejudices and remove suspicion. His plans, therefore, contained all sorts of elaborate suggestions designed to guard the public against fancied dangers. Central banking is our greatest strength. And to persuade the country that the general scheme was at all practicable. Remember, when they started this, USA had no debt at all. It was the hope of Mr. Warburg that with the lapse of time, it might be possible to eliminate from the law a few clauses which were inserted, largely at his suggestion, for educational purposes. Now that the public debt of the United States has passed $1 trillion, we may indeed admit, quote, how great is the indebtedness of the United States to Mr. Warburg, a very nice ironic phrase. At the time he wrote the Federal Reserve Act, the public debt was almost non-existent. Professor Seligman points out Warburg's remarkable prescience that the real task of the members of the Jekyll Island Conference was to prepare a banking plan which would gradually educate the country and break down prejudices and remove suspicion. The campaign to enact the plan into law succeeded in doing just that. So that concludes chapter one, which we see that they did this in secret because it was against the interests of America. And if America had known what was happening, although there would have been some support, there would have been a huge amount of opposition, and it might not have worked. So, in essence, the creation of the Federal Reserve was a conspiracy. Anyway, I've been Alex Linder reading to you from The Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins. And you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, my forum, and also I post the links on pieville.net, which is our Twitter-style social media. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you again for more from Eustace Mullins real soon.